Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Broadway star, television star, great folk singer, active politician, bon vivant, Theodore Bacall. Theodore, it's nice to have you here. I wish it could be a more...
It would be a better day, a better evening to have a friendly visit. We can still be friendly, you and I, but somehow everything is marred today. You know, we won't... it's been 10 hours now, hasn't it, since it happened? About
approximately 10, almost 11 hours now.
And these past 10 hours, the first one was numbed, and then he went into a state of shock. And then, at least if you want my reaction, I got terribly mad. I got so angry. I got angry at anger, and I got angry at hate, and I got angry at the whole picture. Believe me, I don't consider Texas the Deep South. It isn't part of the Deep South, but I've made many trips down there lately. And you remember when Kennedy himself accused Governor Wallace, and rightly, of having created a climate in his state, in Alabama, that made it possible for four little children to get bombed to death in a church. And I make the same accusation against that whole area of making possible a climate of hatred that allows a woman who normally would be a normal housewife to clobber the United States ambassador to the United Nations over the head with a sign, that allows people to spit at the UN ambassador, that allows them to turn around in the same breath and say, it was a Negro that pushed me, and then you look at the press photographs and there's not a single colored face on that whole photograph. It's a climate that was created down there of hatred and of bigotry and of a possibility of a General Walker, now demoted, living right there in Dallas, flying the United States flag upside down every day to show that, in his opinion, the President of the United States is a traitor. That kind of climate is what I accuse of this dastardly deed that's been done. And it's a terrible deed. It hasn't happened. Everybody will tell you that all the terrible things can't happen in this country. It can't happen here. It can only happen in Iraq and in Iran and in Egypt and in South America and little shoddy republics that shoot their presidents or their dictators every now and again. All of a sudden, not only can it happen, but it has happened in our own country. Now, what would have happened if this had come to pass during one of his visits abroad, in Paris, in the south of France, in Vienna, when he went to see Khrushchev?
I made that remark.
We would have declared war, wouldn't we?
I made that remark this afternoon when we first heard it. I said, it's lucky it was an American or it happened here in the United States, because had it been overseas, had it been some extremist overseas, a communist overseas, or any right-wing radical from overseas, there surely would have been war declared in some fashion, or at least panic would have set in some direction. So... beyond all belief, but the moderates in the South, the so-called moderates in the South, or in the Southwest, or wherever they exist, even here in Boston, refuse to raise their voices when hatred and bigotry and prejudice pervades the land. They just won't raise their voice. And I think the president always tried to stay to the moderate left or right of center, where the American people wanted to be. Most Americans are moderate, somewhere around the center of the political spectrum. And when nobody raises the voice except one stranger, Ralph McGill of the Atlanta Constitution, mm-hmm. or when we have demagogues running in Mississippi who are running on a hate Kennedy campaign as to who hates Kennedy the most, mm-hmm. what kind of a climate is there? What kind of a climate, politically or otherwise?
Frankly, I felt at switching off my TV set when I saw Senator Russell of Georgia paying tribute to this Kennedy that died and to the Kennedy family as a whole. When I get the Daily Congressional Record, and I do get it, and I do read it, and I see what Russell has to say when Kennedy hasn't been shot at or killed, and then to have it to get him on my TV set eulogizing. Well, if he had any tact or any feeling at all, he would have stayed out of the picture and would have said no comment and locked himself in his office. That's what a decent man does. But these are not decent men. I'm afraid I can't. I don't hold a brief. I don't believe in the Eastlands and the Russells of this age. They are as much to blame as anybody else. I'm not saying that they pointed a gun, but they didn't stop a gun from being pointed. And this day and age, I'm telling you, non-action is an act. And it's an act that helps the other side.
Our guest tonight at midnight here on the new WMEX in Boston, Channel 1510, we've suspended our regular programming, is Theodore Bakel. Theodore, I know you were in town to perform a concert. What happened with the concert?
Well, I canceled it. It was due to take place tonight. There's another one tomorrow, but I don't think that day, this Friday, when a president of the United States got shot, I could have gone on stage and sung freedom songs. It would have been fitting. One could have acquitted oneself, but somehow there's also this whole aspect of entertainment. I couldn't have done it, really. It couldn't be done. So we've canceled and rescheduled it for Sunday afternoon. And even then, whatever proceeds there will be, on my part at any rate, will be donated to the Southern Freedom Movement, because I believe this is one of the reasons why those who raise guns and raise fists and raise clubs wanted to get the president and ultimately got to him. I don't know, we don't know really who killed him yet, but I know what kind of men they are. And the far right and the far left, to my mind, are one and the same. Whatever he stood for, and he stood for a lot of things. Among other things, he was the first president who really brought in a civil rights proposal. It may not have gone far enough, it may not have been fast enough, but he was the only one, the first one, who really brought it in and intended to see it through. And for that reason, I'll give whatever fee there is from tonight's, the concert that was due to take place tonight, to the Southern Freedom Movement, to the student movement.
How did you view the president, Theodore? Did you feel he was a president in the context of a kind of president with a philosophy that you expound yourself? You, I know, are a liberal. If any labels can be put upon people, and it's hard to even label the president who could have been called a liberal conservative or even a conservative liberal, who was screamed upon by the left and by the right on many occasions for not moving quickly enough, for not doing this. But as you look back over the 2 years and 10 months, there was a great deal accomplished in that 2 years and 10 months, and you don't really realize it until you sit down and assess it, read about it, understand it. Was he the kind of a president you favored, the kind of a man that you looked toward for leadership?
Well, having stood on platforms during the 1960 presidential campaign, and having spoken for the election of John F. Kennedy as president on many platforms, on one occasion, on two occasions even, together with him, and on about three other occasions with Mrs. Roosevelt, obviously I do embrace the political philosophy and by and large the whole of the Kennedy program and the Kennedy philosophy, as far as the discharge of his duties went. I have here and there have had reservations and disagreements with one or the other item that emanated from the White House, but which one of us doesn't? And if I make a sum total, and I'm not saying this because of that lovely Latin proverb of de mortuis nil nisi bonum, of the dead nothing but good is spoken. These days not even that is true anymore. We often speak ill of the dead. No. By and large, if I'm to sum up, there's been more in JFK's program that I myself would have welcomed and embraced and warmly fought for had I been in any comparable position than any other president before him, with the exception of perhaps 3 or 4 years out of FDR's life where one felt this was it.
I think there's a comparable analogy to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the respect that Mr. Roosevelt was hated, but hated still today by those of the extreme right and of the extreme left. We were in hard times back in the 30s. There were many people espousing the socialist cause, many people espousing the communist cause, and many people from the reactionary front who were attacking FDR in every respect whatsoever. His personal life, he was called a Jew, his family, It was just an unbelievable campaign of hatred. And President Kennedy, first took office, I had the impression that he was also going to be a very controversial president. Civil rights, all kinds of economic issues that would hard press the business or reactionary community in some respects. And he did turn out to be that.
Look at the steel. Remember the steel crisis?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he told them off. And he had my fullest admiration for that, because nobody ever thumbed a nose at Wall Street. It wasn't a thumbing a nose. It wasn't a prank saying, look, I'm the president, I'm bigger than you are. They had bargained in bad faith, and he told them. Not only told them, but told them in front of the world. Usually one does that, you call them in the back room and tell them where nobody could hear, and then the next day somebody withdraws a new price hike, and the whole thing is hushed up. But not with JFK. He let the world know, and let America know, that when labor bargains for a rise in wages, then the employer can't turn around and pass that thing that was hardly, that was fought for, with really over the bargaining table, very hard and very arduous, in arduous negotiation. You can't turn around and pass that on to the consumer, because you're not giving away something that you yourself are giving away. And he told them that, and it's a very important principle of labor and of union practice that he upheld. In that instance,
you might remember back to the campaign for the presidency, since you were involved in that campaign, that many people were saying that John F. Kennedy was too young for the presidency, too inexperienced, and that Mr. Nixon was claiming the experience at the time, having been vice president for two terms, knowing world leaders, etc. And it seems to me that the man never makes the presidency, but the president's chair always makes the man. Because even if John F. Kennedy didn't have the basic administrative experience, the chair became him. And I think the Bay of Pigs invasion, which he admitted was his fault, his administration's fault, which is a bitter pill politically to swallow, and he swallowed it by admitting that the faults were his, was an indication that the man was growing to the chair, that the chair makes the president what he is, the kind of responsibilities that a man must assume. And a man 45, 44 years of age, assuming this sort of responsibility, the largest power on earth, is unbelievable. And I think that he had grown. He had truly grown in that seat.
I don't know. I think maybe even with the Bay of Pigs, he was a little nobler, or he behaved a little more nobly than he needed to. Because frankly, the Bay of Pigs was prepared a long time before he ever got to be president. And the program, admittedly, he would have had it in his power to stop it by his word, and didn't, because it was a long-range program that had been prepared and worked out. But he could have very well blamed it on totally and wholly on the Eisenhower administration, yet didn't. I don't know whether the president's chair really adds to the man, because, let's face it, if the other gentleman, who is alive, and therefore we can speak ill of him, had gotten to be president, he would have been alive today. He wouldn't have done anything to offend anybody. But he wouldn't have stood for anything either. So I don't know how much the chair... I know, I'm an actor, I can appreciate it. You know, put a purple of a king on me and a crown, and I feel regal. Something in there. But there was also some greatness, perhaps innate greatness in a man that makes him rise, makes him capable of rising to what the chair demands. And that perhaps is what JFK had, and what I don't think Nixon has or ever will have.
Do you think that the Lyndon Baines Johnson will arise to the occasion? I somehow have the feeling that Mr. Johnson will arise to the occasion, realizing politically that in the United States, being from Texas, that it's a very difficult thing to take a stand, for instance, on civil rights. The vice president, when he assumed the mantle of the vice presidency, shed the robe of a segregationist or even a moderate. He became a liberal in the true sense of a liberal.
It's an interesting notion, Jerry. I don't know at this point, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if he didn't turn around and... Well, there's several things he can do. He can say, I'll sit out the term, right? I'll let the wheels that have been set in motion ride the way they are going now. You know, those that go smoothly, fine. Those that don't, we'll stop them. And I'll sit it out. Another thing that he can do is he could, inasmuch as he's not just a replacement president, but he is a president, he can dismiss the whole cabinet as it stands to the last man and create a new one of his own and scrap the whole program and bring in a new one. He can do that. Or else he can continue the JFK program with the same vigor and visionary leadership, as much of it as he is capable of, and he probably is capable of quite a lot. I think perhaps the last possibility is the strongest one. I don't believe that he will turn the tables completely, that he'll dismiss the cabinet and create a moderate, wishy-washy one. I think he'll continue in the steps of JFK. Somehow, we live in this kind of a world, in this kind of an era. When the Pope died, the new Pope, you will recall, continued in his footsteps with even more incisiveness, perhaps. Now, I think Lyndon Johnson is going to take a little bit of a cue from that.
It seems, I mentioned a little bit earlier, that there's a truly personal feeling about the late president. I suppose it's because of television. I feel as if I know many of the television actors, although I never met them in my life. I see them every week. They become friends to us. And President Kennedy was that. He was a friend to me. I felt like I could just go up and talk to him, although I never met the man, never had any personal acquaintanceship, never even saw him in person, as a matter of fact. I don't recall ever having seen him in person. But there's still the feeling that I know him, and I think that most people in the United States got that feeling because of television, because of the intimacy of the medium. And I'm sure since you've been on television, Theo, on many an occasion, you have met people.
Oh, sure. That insisted they knew you from somewhere where you've never been.
Mm-hmm. So there is that in this era. President Lincoln, when he was assassinated, maybe it was some far distant corner that these people lived in. Well, that was the president. He was in Washington, and I don't know too much about him. But today, everybody knew about the president.
In fact, everybody second-guessed the president. That's the point. You see, we feel, and there may be something in that. Somebody once said, Nelson, I suppose. Could it have been Nelson? Why would he have made it? Every soldier wears a field marshal's baton in his knapsack. Do you remember? Why would Nelson have used an army rather than a navy expression? But anyway, I recall it was Nelson who said it. Another saying says that every child that is born, potentially, is the president, can become or might become the president of the United States. In a sense, there's something in that. I used to scoff at that and say that's ridiculous, you know. I would hate to think that just anybody can become the president of the United States. It takes a pretty special guy. But every one of us, especially in recent years and months, carried a little bit of the president's burden on our shoulders, because we saw him every Wednesday on the news conferences. When an awkward question was put to him, you kind of feel he's like a quiz program. If you know the answer, you wish he would say the right thing, and if you don't know the answer, you wish that he would. And you feel that you're participating in this. So while your own little troubles keep you, if you're a housewife in the kitchen or if you're a bank clerk in your bank, somewhere in the back of your head there's also the burden of presidency, which has been put before you because of the public communications media. And that perhaps, you see, neither Truman nor Eisenhower involved the people of the United States to any extent comparable with that of JFK. We saw him. He was constantly with us. And it wasn't a public relations job. It may have, you know, the innovation.
I don't think it was a public relations job. It was just that the Kennedy family, and as the president said in his inaugural address, this was a new kind of a person occupying the White House, a young wife, a young president with small children, which is almost typical of half the people in the United States today. They were almost seeing themselves up there with the two children, understanding that they have almost the same kind of problems that we do. So there was a close affinity to the President of the United States because of the fact that he was youthful, that he represented this generation, that he represented new and vigorous leadership when it was turned over to him from Mr. Eisenhower, and the communications, I think, put the spotlight upon him because he was interesting, because he was an exciting man to watch, and because his wife and children were exciting to watch.
You see, we could think of, you know, while everybody could think of Mamie as Mamie, nobody ever thought of Eisenhower as Dwight. And we could think of JFK as Jack very easily. And everybody in this country, all of a sudden, for the past 2 years, had a brother Bobby.
I think that was it, that informal intimacy, and of course the television makes it that much more intimate. And again, I'm sure that the President of the United States was aware of his public image, how he was doing.
Oh, sure.
Whether the people accepted him as a popular president. He was probably the most popular president since FDR. And it's strange that he should take the risks involved. This morning, the film showed the president breaking lines, shaking hands with hundreds of admirers in Fort Worth and in Dallas, and Secret Service men obviously worried around him every time he did that. Right here in Boston, on his last visit, he walked down the streets of Boston, went from any building, could have been a sniper. And, of course, Secret Service people worried about this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the president truly enjoyed people. He really liked, I think, best of all, campaigning. Campaigning, I think he enjoyed the presidency. Yeah. He liked being the president of the United States, and he enjoyed campaigning because he was meeting people and because people liked him as an individual. What they liked his policies was something, again, because here in the midst of Texas, where he barely took the state last time, where there was all sorts of bitter opposition, here he was getting a tremendous reception. I can't still comprehend what has happened.
You know, what might be a good thing for you to do, if you can find it by tomorrow night, you'll still be in the same state, and we will be for quite a few days to come. Look in your record library, if somewhere you have a record called The Lonesome Train. It's an old work, about 20 years old, I guess, written by Millard Lampell, and performed beautifully. It's about Lincoln's funeral train. It has this recurring theme of a lonesome train on a lonesome track, seven coaches painted black. And it paints the picture of Lincoln as the president in such warm terms. You couldn't... They were his people. He was their man. You couldn't quite tell where the people left off and where Abe Lincoln began. And then it speaks of the assassination and saying there's a foe that comes face to face with you and slugs it out. But then there's the copperhead. He used, a country term. A copperhead is a kind of a snake that a rattlesnake warns you. A copperhead doesn't. It just strikes out from the bushes without any warning. And that's what felled both Lincoln and John F. Kennedy. It's a good record. I play it every year when I used to have my radio program on the on Lincoln's birthday. And somehow it always moved me very deeply. And I think it would move people now to draw the analogy once more, because there are the haters in there. And there are those who stand by the president. He said, while the president is on while his hearse is on the funeral train, he isn't really in the casket. He's sitting in a hospital holding a soldier's hand who was wounded and talks to him about the battle. And he's standing on a corner, and he's standing in a little wooden church with a preacher saying, you can bury him in the east, you can bury him in the west, but you hear the trumpet sound in the morning. It's that kind of thing.
Our guest tonight is Theodore Bakel. This is Jerry Williams. We've suspended our regular programming tonight on the new WMEX in Boston in order to bring you news of the tragic event that occurred today, background information, special public affairs programming. I could think of no better person to talk with regarding this tragic event today than Theodore Bakel, the Broadway star, television star, folk singer, who was scheduled to appear in Boston tonight but canceled the event, and who will appear but will donate, as he said a little bit earlier, the fee involved to the freedom movement, which he feels is part of the reason why President Kennedy was tragically killed. And tonight we're discussing it from all points of view, sometimes a bit emotional, sometimes a bit happy in terms of the kind of life this man led. And if we go back, Theodore, to the president, and we're right here in his own backyard.
Yes.
Right here in his bailiwick, where his grandmother still, his paternal maternal grandmother still lives. The Kennedys, I'm sure, deeply in grief in Hyannisport. This is the background from which he came, right here, from Boston politics, from where the hardest politics in the world are played, right here. And had he not, I don't think, been schooled here in Boston ward politics, been schooled by his dad and by his grandfather, that he never, never would have achieved the presidency, this play for power in the United States. I don't know whether you're familiar with Boston politics. I know you're familiar with New York, Greenwich Village politics, which is just as hard. And when you're fighting people like Carmine DiSapio, you're involved basically in the same kind of thing.
That's right. I'm familiar with Boston, too, because I do read these books.
The books never tell you. They really never tell you.
What's the last hurrah?
On the intricacies. I think the last hurrah was a nice sentimental sort of book. But not quite... the hard knocks that Boston politics really is. And the president had to go through this sort of thing. And I have a contempt.
I forget, did he go through state office at all?
He ran for Congress.
No, state office.
No, he never ran for state office. He ran for Congress first. This was his first...
Well, he had three terms, isn't it?
Right. First try at political office, then into the Senate against Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr. And I'm always contended that if you serve in the legislature here in Massachusetts, you surely are ready for Congress of the United States, because it is a hard, rough-and-tumble game, as is the Congress. The Congress we're pretty far removed from here, but we understand our state politics a great deal better, and it's basically the same. We have 240 representatives and 40 senators, and it's hard knocks. Believe me, it's hard knocks. And to win a seat constantly takes fortitude, takes the proper image, takes background... it takes a great many things, and the president, having been schooled here in Boston, I think was the best schooling for him to attain the presidency.
Let me ask you a question, which is, life goes on. I'm sure it won't appear callous that we talk about the future when the present is so much with us. But what do you think that bullet did to Goldwater, by way of speculation?
I really don't know yet. It would seem to me, in my first impression when I heard the television report, my first impression was that it was some hater. It was some extremist. It had to be an extremist.
Yeah.
There's too much extremism in the United States, the most I've ever seen since the late 1930s and the early 40s, when the Bund movement was underway, when there was all sorts of anti-Semitism, when there were the pro-Nazi movements in this country. I've really never seen such a magnitude of hate groups around. And it was my first impression that this has got to be some sort of an extremist, left or right, who knows. And that if it was a right-wing extremist, Goldwater, who never really denounced these people because he knew a good deal of his emotional support came from them, he merely said that Robert Welch was not his kind of person, but there were many nice people in the John Birch Society. Mm. I frankly have never met a nice person in the John Birch Society.
Right.
And so I would think that it would destroy Goldwater if the assassin had been from the right wing of our political framework. And I think that if it is proved to be somebody from the left wing, that the right wing will become even more inflamed and more emotional and seize upon what has happened as an I told you so sort of campaign.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think it's a fairly accurate prediction. I thought so myself. I had the president, as you know, I told you when I learned the news, we only heard that the president had been wounded. And one felt, all right, didn't know how severe it was. If it had been a wound that would heal with a little time, that would knock out Goldwater's chances for re-election altogether, because there's an added glamour in having been shot at, and having faced danger for your belief. But now that the president is dead, and if it was really a left-wing extremist, as some things indicate it might be, might have been, Cuban or something, then it might well be that, ironically be, that the right wing, who were Kennedy's biggest opponents, will seize upon his death to make a martyr of him, and in accusing the left wing and riding, wishing to ride to power on the back of Kennedy's hearse. A pretty frightening thought, frankly. Frightening thought.
Well, we don't know yet, and I think this is speculation at this point, but I seem to think that in American politics, that politicians are thinking about politics right now.
Oh, yeah.
And that even through the grief of the time, that there is politics, and I think one of the CBS reports was that, no doubt about it, people were thinking in high echelons of government what would happen to the candidacies of various people for the presidency of the United States, whether Lyndon Johnson would only sit out the 1 year and not run again, or whether he would run again. My speculation is that he'll run, and he'll run again, and I can't conceive of who will be the vice president, but with this, it's inconceivable. This hasn't happened in my time. Does that ever happen in your time?
If he builds up any record of note at all, he will run. And even if he doesn't, he will run.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there will be a tendency for some of the president's proposals now to get further support in the Congress as a result of the assassination?
You're thinking of the civil rights package.
Well,
the
whole raft of proposals.
Yeah. All right, the foreign aid proposals already were, you know, have been disposed and been part of. I would have thought that the best tribute that all these cats that pay lip service on television tonight to the president and his memory, the best tribute they could pay is to get on the ball and pass the packages that he himself had endorsed and presented to them and get on with the business in passing them and stop their filibustering and stop their stalling and hemming and hawing, because it's very easy to lose legislation. If they really want to pay tribute, that's what they ought to do.
I agree with you, Theodore. Last night, Senator Paul Douglas was here on this program, probably, in my mind, one of the greatest senators this country has ever seen. I give him great respect because he's been with so many unpopular causes and has stuck with them. He's now involved in a truth in lending bill. He's involved in the Krabiazin fight, which is a very unpopular fight at the particular moment against large forces like the American Medical Association. I asked him about the president's legislation. What did he think? And he thought, sadly enough, that this was one of the unhappiest Congresses that he has since sat upon, simply because the committee chairmanships are in Southern hands. Mm-hmm. They can't move any of the legislation out of committee. They can't move because of procedure, and that he was endorsing some of Senator Joe Clark's administrative and legislative procedural changes so that they may move this legislation quickly. But he wasn't very optimistic at all. And these Southern senators who sit upon these chairmanships could very well snap their fingers, move the legislation out, and prove that the country comes first rather than one district of Georgia or one district of Mississippi.
Well, there's another thought that occurred to me, and that is probably, and I hope Lyndon B. Johnson will follow up on this. You know, of course, that an executive order is in force only for as long as the president in question holds office. It dies the day he leaves the office. There were several executive orders that Kennedy signed in anticipation of later passage of House or Senate or joint bills to make them law, but which of course haven't reached fruition yet. I'm thinking in particular of two. One is the establishment of the Arts Council, Federal Arts Council, which he established only a matter of like 3.5 months ago by executive order, which presumably now is defunct inasmuch as he no longer holds the office. The other is the draft bill. You recall that this is even newer. About 2 months ago, Kennedy signed an executive order freeing all married men from the draft. Now, this, too, will have to either be ratified by Congress in order to remain in force, which, because of their calendar, they won't do this session, or else LBJ will have to, if he wants them, will have to sign an executive order on his part in order to keep them in force.
How do you assess the character of the new president? I think the new president, again, becomes fair game, just like JFK was when he was president of the United States. I think I supported, in principle, almost every measure the president had proposed, his Medicare program, his a tax cut program, his foreign aid program, the federal aid to education program. I supported his civil rights program. I think all of these things, it seems to me a great many of the people of the nation supported, except various strong pressure groups from across the nation.
The lobbies, in fact.
Yeah. I'm wondering now whether Lyndon Baines Johnson, the next president of the United States, is going to be able to move this, and whether really, as I look back, he probably was the master politician in the United States Senate. Everybody looked toward him for leadership while he was the Senate Majority Leader. He was an astute politician. Nobody ever thought he ever would become President of the United States merely because he was from the South or Southwest. And if you remember during the campaign, he insisted it was the West he was from, not the South. As I look upon Mr. Johnson, he seems to me like a bit of Harry Truman because of the naturalness of his talk, because of the earthy flavor that he still maintains.
The farm flavor.
That's right. And he's not what I would call a glamorous president. But there is something strange about Mr. Johnson that somehow I can't quite interpret to myself. What is this business about LBJ? And what is this business about the initials that are so important to him and every member of his family? Lady Bird Johnson. Everybody in the family has...
That's right.
An
Linda,
LBJ.
He has one daughter, Linda, and another daughter... I don't know what she
calls. And in his office, there are three full paintings of Mr. Johnson himself. As he sits in his office, he may gaze upon these paintings.
It doesn't disturb me at all. I mean, the paintings, that may disturb me. I don't know about them. But the initials, it's just so you don't have to change vowels. But, you know, I mean, it's easy. It's easy for the luggage. It's easy for the towels, you know.
I'm just wondering if you assess the character of a man. You take everything into consideration and wonder whether this has any indication of the man's individual integrity. Of course, question his integrity.
If that's his only vanity that he has, his initials and a couple of paintings, let's let him have it.
I agree with you on that. All right. On the new WMEX Boston, Channel 1510, this is Jerry Williams. We've suspended our regular programming to bring you special WMEX public affairs programming. Our guest tonight talking about the tragic event that occurred today in Dallas, Texas. Theodore Bacall, the Broadway star of television, the great folk singer, discussing, and of course, he is also, as he has told you, campaigned vigorously for President Kennedy.
I'm a county committeeman from New York, Democratic County committeeman.
And fought very strongly in that particular district against Carmine DiSapio, unseated Carmine DiSapio, in a very, very bitter and emotional fight. I might ask you, just for the record, what is happening in your district and what is happening to Carmine DiSapio, who I understand was going to rerun.
Well, he did rerun this past primary and lost by 41 votes, which is quite amazing because the man who ran against him, Ed Koch, former president of the Village Independent Democrat, has had neither the financial means nor the physical way of following through. Carmine DiSapio has quite a lot of pressure groups, or gangs, if you will, wandering around the village. Also, the primary was held at a very bad time. It was held about 3 days after Labor Day, and most of the people who vote reform would not have returned to town, whereas DiSapio's people never even leave town. That's all South Village and a very staid Italian district. Still in all, he lost by 41 votes, went to court yelling irregularity. Of course, you can't even know on behalf of whom the irregularity is, because the irregularity may have been on... And they only found 35 irregularly cast votes. And the law quite clearly states that it must be proven that the irregularities could have made a difference in the election. But even if all the 35 had been in favor of the Sapio, which was, there was no way of determining, you can merely say that the machine made a mistake or the registrar made a mistake, but there's no way of knowing for whom these irregulars, so-called, voted. Even if you assume that all 35 had voted for Kama and the Sapio, it still wouldn't have changed the fact that Ed was elected. I was offered the candidacy to run against Carmine this year. In fact, three times. Thrice they offered me the crown, and thrice I refused it, because although I may be ready to run and win, and I probably would have, perhaps by a greater margin than Ed, I'm not ready to sit in politics and deliver what the job calls for yet. And having berated Mr. DeSapio for years for not delivering what the job calls for, I wasn't about to get elected and do the same thing.
Theodore, we've talked about the national consequences of the president and his tragic death, but we haven't talked about the international consequences. And I've been giving some thought to this. Soviet Premier Khrushchev and others throughout the world, I think, had a hearty respect for President Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
And I think on the international level, that politics is even more personal than it is on a national level. We see the president as somewhat far removed from us, somewhat. Mm-hmm. Personally, we feel close to him, but politically, we're somewhat far removed. But when it comes to international politics, the personal kind of diplomacy has taken over since post-war. Harry Truman through the Eisenhower administration, and now even more personal during the Kennedy administration. Soviet Premier Khrushchev, it seems to me, had a hearty respect for the President of the United States. Look at the recent release of Professor Bogworn.
Sure, and Kennedy yelled when he meant business, and they knew that he meant business, and were duly impressed. They withdrew their arsenal of materials from Cuba when we yelled hard enough, and it was, believe it, well, we all know, a big gamble. We really stood on the brink of something terrifying. But Kennedy felt that you had that. There comes a point when you say, so far, buddy, and no further. You don't shout it too soon, and you don't shout it too often, because you dissipate by crying wolf too often.
Well, evidently, the president's timing in that respect was superb.
Yeah, extraordinary. Superb. Extraordinary.
And this is what I'm beginning to think now. Since international politics is on such a personal level, what are the consequences of a change over here? As a matter of fact, there were reports from the Soviet Union today that the people in the Soviet Union were shocked, dismayed, and couldn't quite understand what was going on because they're not aware of the makeup of the United States government. They are not told the truth about the United States government, and they, as a matter of fact, the reports are, do not even know who Lyndon Baines Johnson is, have no idea of his background, have no idea from whence he comes. So they're beginning to feel that this is somewhat like Haiti, that there's been a coup d'etat that took place of sorts, and how will our next president get along with Premier Khrushchev when surely the Russian people, as are the American people, do not want a war. They don't want anything beyond this. Further, I've heard from Soviet experts that the young people growing up in the Soviet Union are tired of the rhetoric of the Marxists and the Leninists, so to speak, tired of the talk about the capitalist Wall Street Wall Street warmongers, and are looking for something different. And this is one of the reasons why jazz, for instance, is somewhat looked upon askance by Soviet officials, because it was making an impact upon the young people who were tired of the communist rhetoric.
And cut across boundaries.
So what is going to happen?
Of course, it's not the Soviet people that that I am worried about at the moment. It's the Soviet leadership. Because the Soviet people still do not determine anything in the Soviet Union, no matter what, how they feel, or whether they know or do not know who Lyndon Baines Johnson is, or whether they imagine that he engineered the coup d'etat in order to take over the government, which is quite possible. That kind of thinking would be quite possible in the minds of people who don't know how the United States works, how our system of government is what its fabric is. It's possible that they might harbor such thoughts at the moment, but it's all immaterial, because the Soviet leadership knows quite well how we are set up, and that Lyndon Baines Johnson is a new man, essentially in the same line as the old man, heading at the same kind of government. Now, they will probably start, as they usually do. They're all circus people, and they all are bear trainers or lion tamers or whatever not. They will test, I fear, to see how far they can go and when LBJ, when his breaking point is, when will he yell at them. They usually do that. Have you noticed? Whenever a new president takes office, the Soviets start all sorts of little incidents to find out how he reacts. You know, it's like in a bullfight, they do that all the time. That's what that first cape worked. Maybe very flashy to the public, but it's really to determine the reflexes of the bull.
And it shows how intimate international politics is on a very personal level.
Sure.
One man dealing with one man.
Stopping a convoy in East Berlin or through East Germany to get to West Berlin may have nothing to do with a convoy or with the people in the convoy or with Berlin or with Germany. It may be just a testing ground to find out how Washington will react.
I think at this point, and there were people who were worried this afternoon, that possibly the Soviet Union might start an incident of this type.
Not
at
so
this
soon.
Point.
Not right away. Not right away. They, too, are masters of timing. They'll wait until the mourning has passed and the grief has passed and until the new administration settles into a groove of running a country. Then, I don't believe anything will happen for a couple of weeks or so.
Philosophically, have you lost faith in the world?
No.
Somewhat,
no.
You hear these stories around. Many people are saying today, what's it all about? What's it all for? Why are we here? How could this have possibly happened?
Jerry, if my faith in the world had depended upon complete stability and a complete absence of lunatics, it wouldn't have been worth much. And if an incident, shocking and tragic and terrible as it may be, such as this, should cause one to throw up one's arms and go into some nirvana where nothing can happen except a death-like sleep. No, sir. No, faith is made of something, must be made of something stronger than that. Quite frankly, I knew all along that such incidents are possible. I was never one of those who said it can't happen here because it can. Nazis, in my own memory, sprung up in a country that was highly civilized and highly cultured. Radicals can spring up in this country from the right, far right, or the far left. Lunatics can happen not only in Sarajevo in 1914, killing an heir to the throne, but they can spring up any time, any place, including Dallas, Texas, and including, unfortunately, Brookline, Massachusetts, or New York City.
It seems like I've talked about extremists on this program for 6.5 years so many, many times. In effect, I'm very emotional about this sort of thing. I get highly upset with people with very radical points of view. I get upset with them. I don't say that I want to quiet them down. They may have their point of view, but I am very emotional, as probably they are, about their point of view. These people who view conspiracies around every corner. These people who feel psychopathic. Yeah. Psychopathic in the fact that there is a conspiracy here in the United States. And surely the man who killed the president today was one of those who felt that by eliminating the president that the means justifies the end. And it's just unbelievable, and I don't know whether the people of the United States are actually to blame for everything, whether there is a just cause to for everybody to grieve for their own part in this assassination. But they were warned. People were warned in this country by the president many times when he spoke of extreme organizations. And he never would have spoken about it, the president, if he didn't think that this was a threat.
A real one.
Right. If they were just crackpots or just an occasional nut.
But there is no such thing as just crackpots.
That's what I'm saying.
It's a disease, and it's not a disease in itself. It's the symptoms of a rankling disease that has to be stopped. And not just the symptoms, because you can't. Somebody said today, Jim Haggerty it was, when he spoke of security precautions. He said, you could do that at a dinner. In fact, I myself attended the presidential dinner of the Joint Defense League, the B'nai B'rith, in Washington. There were Secret Service men at every single table, and they never once looked at the president. They looked at all of us. Around the table, at all times, while the president was there, every single table had a Secret Service man who faced away from the dais and faced our table and every other table, looking at every single face and every single movement of everybody in the room. That's fine at a dinner, but you can't do that. You can only make a show of force when you ride the streets, because what are you going to do? There's millions of windows in the course of a month that the president passes in a motorcade. And he's got to ride in motorcades, you know, otherwise he becomes some little animal in a cocoon that doesn't lead a nation, that is not within the nation. He's got to be part of the nation. And he knew it, and he had to mingle, and he had to go through the cordon and press and shake hands and rub noses when necessary. It was necessary for him to do that. He wouldn't have been the man that he was if he hadn't. But that the whole point is, you cannot guard against this kind of thing by security alone. You have to somewhere cure the disease, or at least kill the disease by isolating it the way a doctor does. You know, when somebody tells me about George Lincoln Rockwell and they refer to him as a nut, I immediately say, stop that. Don't call him a nut. Because by calling him a nut, you immediately diminish his importance. He's just a lunatic. I don't call him a nut. I call him a danger. And whenever he opens his mouth, I'm there to counteract, to yell against, to be there with a yellow armband or with photographs of concentration camps to show the people what kind of America he wants. That is no longer a mere nut. None of them are. They are dangers, and they have to be treated as such.
I think in spotlighting the extremists and the president and others, Dwight Eisenhower, who I thought never would talk about extremists, never, because a good deal of the Republican support, I'm sure that they don't want, the good Republicans do not want, comes from the extreme right. And a good deal of the so-called liberal support comes from the extreme left.
Left.
So it gave me a little faith in the fact that maybe I wasn't the purveyor of gloom, or that many other people like me who felt strongly about extreme movements weren't the purveyors of gloom, that the president was aware that this was a growing menace, mm-hmm. and that they were capturing opinion. And in his speech, which was prepared in for Dallas this afternoon, he pointed out that opinions of an extreme nature with a nice, simple solution to complex problems, which is what all the extremists offer, a nice, simple, emotional solution to a complex problem, was a great worry in this country.
And it was, you know, it's quite understandable why he was to deliver that speech today and in Dallas, because of the incident that confronted Adlai Stevenson a month ago. Exactly for that reason, and that reason alone, he chose Dallas as the place where he was going to deliver that speech warning against extremists.
I want to interrupt for just a moment. Our guest is Theodore Bakel, a Broadway and stage star. We are here on the new WMEX in Boston. We have suspended our regular programming until further notice. No commercial announcements will be made. We will play appropriate music only, and we will try to recap the tragic incident that occurred this morning in Dallas, Texas, and bring you any future news that is forthcoming. We've been discussing for the past hour the tragic event that occurred today, and I feel that it's fitting we talk about it with Theodore Bakel, who feels strongly about politics, who feels strongly about certain movements. I know you're wearing a button, Theodore, that says, "We shall overcome." And I've heard that song many times, and right here in Boston, as a matter of fact, we just went through a bitter election. I'm sure you must have heard about it, where someone was overwhelmingly reelected to the post of school committee. And it's fantastic because some of the moderates in the community did speak up. Priests from Boston College, the Massachusetts Council of Churches, We were trying to counteract what evidently was hatred, what evidently was prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And still it didn't really get through, because I don't want to pick on the individual now at this time. Nobody quite understood. It was a case of black against white. And in certain respects, we're somewhat like the South, though I think we're somewhat guilty of the same kinds of things, because the business community was quiet. The political community, you never heard a word from. Not a peep. The clergy was active. The clergy was active up here. As you know, there are many members of the Massachusetts Council of Churches who are down in Williamston, North Carolina, at the moment.
The National Council of Churches, by and large a Protestant affair, is very good on the subject. The Catholic Church is extremely good on the subject. Also, the Catholic Church doesn't run as many risks as do, for instance, let's say, the Baptists or the Methodists. You see, and I've been through the South quite a lot, there's a very great, big, and incurable hang-up with the clergy in the South. And unfortunately, it goes for the Jewish clergy as well, I must admit, shamefacedly. In every instance where the clergyman, the minister, the priest, is hired and fired by the community itself, where his salary is paid by the community, he is no longer a leader. He is to some extent led and governed by those whom he's supposed to lead. It is only the Episcopalians who, while the community pays the minister's salary, the bishop sends the minister, or the priest, they call him, to the parish that he's supposed to administer. And the Catholics, who, where the community neither pays nor appoints their own minister, but the bishop or the archbishop or the diocese sends him, and he stays there for the duration at the bishop's pleasure and not the community's. It's only in those cases where the church can afford to speak out from the pulpit fully without fear of contradiction or of being fired the next day. I had many talks. A white, even a well-wisher, and there are not many of those around, a well-intentioned white Baptist or Methodist minister in the South will not speak out, because he's going to be fired the next day. The elders of the community is going to stop paying his salary. He's going to be out on his behind. And even that would then the good sermon he gave yesterday from the pulpit would be of no avail, because that too would only be remembered as a misdemeanor that got him fired. You see?
We're speculating about the whole business of civil rights and the Negro Revolution, and wondering whether this had anything to do with the slaying of President Kennedy. And a good deal of hatred has been whipped up in the United States in the past year. As a matter of fact, the political analysts were speculating over whether or not this would hurt the president in the North when he ran for re-election. And I don't know if this is the root of it, the root of the problem, just pure hatred, whether it is the Negro Revolution, but I'm sure all of it milled together.
Oh, yes.
Brings a fantastic pot of hate.
We have come to accept atrocity, you see. It's terrible, but even the news media get jaded. After all, they're looking to sell newspapers. When atrocities were committed all over the South, people beaten bloody, people mutilated, people thrown into jail without and held without a trial, all this was news for a while. Then girls started to get raped, and children and grown-ups started to get shot, and then children started to get bombed. And then the press got jaded. Nothing short of rape or murder was worth a headline anymore. So the beatings of yesterday were no longer news today, and the beatings of today are no longer news of today, because they're not murder. You see, I once had a press conference for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, with which I work closely, in my apartment in New York City. And one radio station, one newspaper, sent reporters, there were many, were about 20, but this one station, this one newspaper, sent reporters who had heard that some girls had been raped in the South the previous day. And they looked around the room, and since we didn't have any of those girls around, they left without wanting to hear what the press conference was all about. Jaded. our senses get numbed to tragedy. And once you establish a climate, as I said at the beginning of this, of our going on the air, once you establish a climate where murder is an acceptable weapon, where violence is the order of the day, all right, so some murders are more shocking than others, but murder is no longer in itself an abhorrent thing. It happens.
A bulletin. The 24-year-old former Marine Lee Oswald was formally charged tonight with the ambush slaying of President Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only news we have, and of course WMEX will remain on the air through the night and through the day to bring you what further news we have on this particular item. That's all we have. That's the only news we've received so far, but I'm sure there'll be a great deal more forthcoming within the next few hours here on the WMEX in Boston. This is Jerry Williams, my guest tonight, Theodore Bakel, who canceled his concert tonight in Boston and is going to carry on. And tomorrow night, a concert of special songs will be sung by Theodore Bakel, and the fee will be donated to the Freedom Movement.
No, that tonight's will be held on Sunday afternoon.
On Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And as located, where is it going to be?
John Hancock Hall.
And it will be, the entire fee will go to...
Oh, yes, to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
To the Freedom Movement,
yeah.
For, I'm sure, as part of the whole picture here tonight that we've been discussing.